Welcome back to Main Street Firefighting, a podcast by Fire Engineering. My name is Lex Shady, along with my partner, Chris Tobin. Before we get started, we'd like to thank Fire Engineering for this opportunity and you all for tuning in. This month, we had the pleasure of interviewing Captain Greg Redmond from the St. Louis Fire Department. Greg touches on the culture of his department, legacy size-ups, infill buildings, and much more. We hope you enjoy. Welcome back to Main Street Firefighting, a podcast by Fire Engineering. My name is Lex Shady, and with me is my partner, Chris Tobin. Joining us today is Captain Greg Redmond with the St. Louis Fire Department. Greg is currently assigned to Truck 30. Thanks for joining us, Greg. Before we get started, can you give us a little background on your experiences in the fire service?
Sure. I am working on my 24th year. I came on the fire department in 1998, and I was kind of late to the fire service. I didn't know I was going to become a firefighter until I was one, pretty much. Entered through the EMS world, did that for a couple of years, and ended up testing because everyone else was. So I started in 98 on the fire department side, 95 at EMS, and then I promoted in 2010. So I've been a captain in since 2010. Year and a half, 33s, then the 28s, busy company, firefighting company, hazmat, high rise, midtown, little everything. And I spent a couple of years doing administrative stuff, and then I'm 4.5 years at Truck 30.
Has most of your experience been kind of spread out between the engine and truck companies? Do you have one like preference or the other? Can you kind of explain how that works with St. Louis?
Yeah, so St. Louis is the original Quint, as far as I understand it, is the original Quint concept department. So when I say Truck 30, that truck is an engine first. In fact, we all of our engines had ladders on them until 2010, from late 80s till 2010. Now we're sort of a hybrid Quint. I don't remember, Chris, I think we have 13, 14 pumpers now.
Yeah.
Straight pumpers, but we... Like, do you know what the number is?
I think it's two. We had two sets of nine total that came in. So, something, yeah, in or around there. It's weird. It changes.
Yeah, depending on who's in service now or quits. But a truck on the St. Louis Fire Department is a quit. So we are an engine company first. Actually, we have five bucket ladders, as we refer to them, whether it's a stick or a bucket, and those are the, you know, essentially full-time truck companies. So, yeah, we're kind of jacks of all trades, sort of. I don't know about masters of none. I hope we're a master of our skills, but yeah, that's how it works in St. Louis.
Okay. So kind of going off that a little bit, can you tell us a little bit more about like the culture of St. Louis, what the response, manpower, maybe some of your guys' general tactics are at your first in fires?
Well, our response is... kind of interestingly, like I said, since 2010, we entered to the mix, treat them any differently on our responses than the quints. So you could end up, so a still alarm would be three engines or quints, hook and ladder, a rescue squad, and a chief. Upgraded to a first alarm, you're going to get two additional engines and or quints, and another chief. So you could theoretically end up with five engines or five quints at a first alarm fire. So it's a little, I don't know, it's a little unusual. As far as our tactics, we do a dispatch, although really arrival order duties are dictated by arrival order. So the first in has fire attack. Second in has the truck duties. The third in has second engine duties, and we refer to it as backup water. We actually have a redundant supply to the attack. So that first in company will, we don't lay in, not very often. I don't know if I've actually ever seen it. I've heard of companies laying in every now and again, but that's not the standard. We attack off the tank. But we run with four, but the fourth guy is the plug man, and he'll handjack back to the plug. So, but that third engine or third arriving company will function as a second engine, and they will actually pump to them. So we have a redundant supply to that fire attack pumper. Then those guys will take a second line as needed. The fourth in will back up the hook and ladder, as we refer to it, supply the hook and ladder, and then whatever jobs are needed. And fifth in is RIT. And then that leaves the hook and ladder. And hopefully they don't show up first, because if they show up first, that throws everything off. Infrequently, we don't have a whole lot of double houses. So we've gotten to the point where, hook and ladder, five, I think, is the only hook and ladder with an engine in the house. So, you know, there's a chance that they may end up leading off, and that kind of, it can present some challenges. I guess if we get it figured out. Anything more specific you're looking for?
No, that helps just give everybody kind of an understanding of where you're coming from.
Confuses them.
Yeah, or that too. So can you describe your typical building stock that you run on?
Yeah, so forever, St. Louis is a brick city. I mean, I named internal Facebook training group the Brick City Training, because that's just, you know, St. Louis is one of the classic brick cities of this country. Pretty much, man, almost everything was ordinary construction and fire for the longest time. Now we're starting to see, you know, going back in certain areas, we're starting to see some newer construction stuff. It's a city that's lost a lot of population, so there hadn't been a whole lot of new construction in a lot of areas. Just North City's just pretty much depopulated. But so the building stock is a lot of single, two-family brick buildings. Certain neighborhoods, older neighborhoods, will get a row house, too large. Some other areas, you know, the whole city is not a row house city. We've definitely got some neighborhoods. There's a bit of newer stuff, and we're starting to see some fires. And my area is a kind of a blend of some neighborhoods that have seen better times and disrepair, and then also actually it's probably the densest. Lots of apartment buildings and not a lot of vacants. And then we cover the north end of the zoo. So the bulk. We do have a fair number of three-story walk-ups. St. Louis is not it's not a city where you're going to see a lot of four or five-story walk-ups. Few, but not a whole lot of them. But we do have three-story, a few four-story walk-ups.
Yeah, you know, and that's something that I think the 30s still, and by still, you know, for people that are listening, I mean your immediate response area is something that is definitely unique for your building stock out there. Is it almost looks like a kind of a chunk almost like out of Brooklyn or something with all those, the taller, you have that mid-range, you know, four-story building with the high-density brick buildings like that, especially on the backside of like Forest Park Parkway and stuff. It's a really unique kind of scenery,
right?
And you're right, they're all populated. It's heavily densely populated, and it's just definitely a part of the city that's unique, that your specific company covers, that isn't really seen anywhere else in the city, actually. So
it's that stretch from the 28th to Central West End West, and actually, so they're not walk-ups, but they're walk-ups for us, because the elevators in most of them are I don't even know what you'd call legacy elevator. You have the old doorman, sliding gate. Right. I don't know the name. So they're not, I don't like to use one medical calls personally. I'd rather take the stairs on those, but got a fair number where it's going to be a stretch up four or five floors. That's a pretty standard building for us, actually.
Right. And those are generally in what kind of layout? Are those U-shaped or those like E? I think those are longer buildings, right?
Yeah. So we have a mix, and that's part of the, you know, knowing your buildings and sort of making it a, I don't know, for lack of a, well, I you know, new agey word, a kind of a holistic approach to doing what we do is paying attention to what your buildings are. And so you can have that, you know, U-shaped buildings that are center hall buildings, and you can have the U-shaped buildings, you know, the courtyard, mm-hmm. The three-story courtyard where you've got, where they're essentially maybe four or five different buildings functionally, because whether they have firewalls or not, you're only going to get to that unit up that stairwell as opposed to a center hall, right?
Sure, right.
So yeah, there's a fair number of those, and sometimes they're mixed in the neighborhoods where you're seeing some of both. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty interesting mix. I mean, St. Louis's heyday was 100 years ago, and that's when the bulk of our buildings were, you know, were somewhere in that neighborhood, give or take, and that's where many of our buildings were when they were built. So you know, that's the kind of structures we're dealing with for the most part. Now we're starting to see some newer stuff. We, I don't know where else you're seeing quite as much of the new podium construction. We've actually started to see a bunch of that go up, but I think we're probably on our 1-5th one in the still here in the last couple of years. So, you know, kind of getting a real mix of stuff now.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a very eclectic still. Like you said, the podium construction, that's kind of been untested as far as I know in St. Louis. We haven't had any instances in those that I can recall. I do know
we actually had one. It was the 3949 Lindell about 10 years ago, and that was a mess.
That's right. Oh, yeah. I didn't know that was actually podium. I didn't know. Was there a parking garage under that? I guess there was. Yeah, you're right.
It's the parking is in the back, but the podium was retail, the restaurants and all
that's
that.
That's right. And, you're right. Yeah, that was fantastic.
Yeah, that one didn't turn out so well.
Yeah, you're right. So you're right. There is a little bit of history on that. So, and you know, ironically, that one also went under construction, had a fire in it too. Ironically,
it did. Yeah. The thing about that is that made that kind of interesting was that we just saw ourselves as an ordinary construction firefighting department. That's where we fought fires. I think we were maybe a little bit underprepared for how quickly that fire moved. And so that kind of speaks to making sure you stay up with what's going on in your, whether it's renovations or whatever, but the new construction styles, because you get used to your home field advantage and then somebody changes the home field and, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah, it's definitely
still gotta fight that. Still have to fight that fire, right?
Yeah, sure. It's definitely something I've noticed. You know, kind of. It's like you said, we've learned the hard way. I've started to notice the word not ordinary, but new construction come up in size ups. I've heard that start to happen more and more. So we are learning, and we've definitely learned the hard way. You know, we've had one or two instances where people have gone through a roof on a newer building, maybe some exposure problems, but. Stuff like that. So it's definitely on the radar now more than it was before. And you're right. And it's something that we're coming across more and more now. Maybe not a lot. It's very infrequent. I can only count maybe on one hand. I can only count on one hand for sure on a newer building that I've been in.
Yeah.
But when they happen, you know, I think we're getting better at acknowledging that this is different and maybe some things need to happen differently.
Speaks to what understanding building construction and that it's not some esoteric thing to study for a promotional exam. It is, you know, it's I'm not a really fan of the battlefield analogy. That's just not my thing. It's where we, you know, it's our work environment. It's where we, you know, play our unscheduled games, you know.
Sure.
So we certainly need to do our best to keep up.
Yeah, I think that the one challenge that St. Louis has, as well as other old brick cities in the Rust Belt with newer construction, isn't that we don't have entire neighborhoods, right? We have one, maybe that one new house on an entire block of, you know, a half dozen or more older homes that is just hidden. And if you're not good, or you're not, you know, on your game, it's really easy to miss that, you know. And I can understand why we've had some mishaps. They're just so well hidden amongst the environment.
So yeah, we're starting to have some of those things like over on the hill. And there are some neighborhoods that are starting to, where it's going to be clear these are all new construction buildings. But you're right, there's definitely the infill stuff.
Yeah.
Where they're trying to make it fit in. Some of them, you know, some of them are kind of maybe cheaply done. It's just a facade. It's pretty easy to spot.
Sure.
It's, you know, frame building with a, you know, veneer of brick on the facade. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I found a few of them that are like, I don't know, this is, you'd have to be on your game to know that this is not a brick building. It's not going to behave like a brick building.
Right. Yeah.
And like you're saying.
I like that term you said, infill. You know, maybe that's worth a little bit of a small article or something, because I mean, that's really like what we're hitting on here is some of them are wrapped on three sides with a veneer, you know, and they're designed to look like the other two buildings on each side of them, the building across the street. There might be, you know, a general block in the city of St. Louis has about 10 addresses on each side of it, depending on the length of the block. And all of a sudden you have this one house in the middle there that was built last year. And you gotta kind of know some stuff, you know, or say the fire building is an old type three, but that might be an exposure you're going into. So you're not even thinking about that. You've already sized this fire up as, you know, a two story brick, you know, fire on the second floor, but that exposure now is lightweight. So that's even farther removed. That's one, you know, level removed from, I guess, a general strategic perception. But yeah, I like that term infill. And maybe that's something worth writing up on, because it definitely takes a little bit of an eye to catch some of these. And this, like you said, some of them are blatantly obvious. You know, we have houses now that are built with Connex boxes that look completely modern, you know. So, right. I mean, obviously there's easier ones.
Yeah, in McCreetown, they're building a modern infill stuff. But yeah, in some of the neighborhoods in Benton Park and mm-hmm. other areas, I'm definitely seeing some of the infill design to fit into the old, you know, brick look.
And that just goes back to getting out in your districts and really knowing where those buildings are at. So,
not enough people are doing. I recall when I started driving at the 32s, my first assignment, I started driving after briefly in our department. It's kind of an informal process to drive, and I complained about the guy blowing a run, and so they just made me the driver. So I became a driver. And anyway, driving back from runs from the store, I'm just curious by nature. So I'd be driving 20 miles an hour with my head out the windshield, looking at the different buildings, because mm-hmm. that's just my nature. At that point, it wasn't. I don't even think it was like me trying to figure out what I'm going to do when the building was on fire. It's just me being curious. And then as I, you know, experience through and the value of understanding, you know, what the layout, what's inside those buildings, that it, you know, just my sort of curious nature about the building stock itself certainly helped.
Sure. Yeah. You know, you hit on something that a lot of people don't realize, is you said driving back at 20 miles an hour, and that goes towards, you know, I tell people, you know, if you have a city with a lot of interstates or main thoroughfares that are 45, 50, you know, or more, like, stay off those when you're coming back from runs, and get on your side streets and take those back. Take the scenic route, because your environment changes at 20 miles an hour from on the interstate, right? And then even, like, think about when you walk, how much difference you get out of what you're looking at, you know, how it just slows down. You start picking up the details, because you're going
absolutely
slow, right? So, and that's something that we're good at, because, you know, we're not a city of interstates, really, right? Like, everything's a side street, or for the most part, you know, smaller streets. But that's just something I tell people when they're, you know, if they want to get in touch with their environment, to kind of slow it down and you know, drive slower. You're going to see more that way.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, absolutely. I try to encourage people not to just try to get back to the engine house as soon as they can.
Right, you know? Sure, right. And
There's a lot to see out there, and it's gonna benefit you one of these days.
Oh yeah. Because I mean, like it or not, it's all getting loaded into your brain, right? I mean, that's all part of your recall. And we've had some other podcasts and other chiefs have said, you know, they're new guys. They recommend taking a drive around there still on their, you know, when they're off in the morning, just to get familiar with the buildings and stuff, which is what I just did on my own anyways. And my captain actually did recommend that, because I wasn't from St. Louis. So that was just what I did. Every morning I got off work and I did a couple laps around some neighborhoods and, you know, really oriented myself to my environment. And it cost me nothing, right? You know, the time I invested in that paid dividends in the future. So just simple stuff like that.
So as we keep talking about, like, driving the streets and looking at buildings and stuff, Greg, was there something specific that piqued your interest in building construction, like a specific incident that made you realize you needed to take a deeper look at your buildings? Or was this just, like you said, your curiosity kind of expanded into wanting to know more?
I got a lot of questions. I got a lot of questions guy. I didn't grow up in the fire service. It was, again, something. So I just didn't get some things. And the accessibility to the information that's out there now wasn't so available in, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s. Probably the biggest event or whatever that kind of changed things for me was the Charleston Sofa Superstore fire. And, you know, that's not about, you know, an ordinary two-family, single-family construction building, but it was really just the amount of diving into and report that came after and just how, you know, how you could really look at how we operate. Other than that, I'm not sure that there was a specific event. It's just over time, as I've, you know, spent a lot of time. I mean, I've probably learned more in the last 5 years than I did in my first 18 years, that I've just realized just how important it is to really understand your building. Understanding building construction, to me, is our way of knowing as much about and eliminating as many variables as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know if that makes much sense or not. It does to me, but that doesn't always mean it makes sense to other people.
I think it makes total sense. So kind of going off that, like eliminating variables and stuff, what clues do you utilize to identify buildings?
Well, so we look at patterns in the buildings, like, you know, buildings that are similar, because, you know, if you recognize what the patterns are, whether window placement or where doors are or just that particular building style, they're typically going to have a pattern. As you are in a low vis environment, you're trying to make progress through there, you know something about how that building's laid out. Or conversely, if it turns out it isn't laid out like that, that's more information that you know, like, hey, there have been some changes made to this building, right? This building is not the way it was originally laid out. So yeah, roofs, you know, so I've gotten, you know, I try to make sure the guys understand, like, I'm asking about roof types, not because it's a trivia contest, because it's not a trivia contest. Those roofs, the names of the roofs will help them understand, like, what's under them. What do we call this? And Chris, we kind of that whole half story, you know, thing that you're like, what in the end, what does that tell us about what we do? You know, what does that half story, does it mean? It tells us something about that space up there. So, so those are the things that we try to look at. What indicates that there's a framed out space, potential living space. What tells us that it's unlikely that it's more like an unfinished attic or, just sort of patterns that we can look for.
Right. And yeah. You
know, whether or not we can get into the buildings.
Sure. You know, I think that's just a really, really good principle that, not enough people hit on, because I don't think people are asking, you know, I mean, in the case of you, obviously you are an officer, so you are responsible for a good part of decision making, depending on what arrival order you are in. And then, and that's the thing is, when was the last time a member came up and said, hey, what are you looking at? When you show up, like, other than being asked just now by us, you know, or when was the last time someone asked a chief, hey, when you're looking at this building, what's your thought process? What are you looking at? And I don't think people realize that's different for a lot of people, depending on your pedigree, depending on, you know, what how you came up in the fire service, what you know.
Sure.
And I think people discount that, and it's something that maybe it's a question that needs to be asked more frequently, because, like, in the case of you right now, if you were to ask you that question, we would have no idea. When you look at a building, we would have no idea what's happening, right? You know, how you're triaging that. And then that's also a very good opportunity to basically learn from someone like you, or maybe a battalion chief who says, yeah, you know, when I'm looking at a building, here's what I'm looking for. Here's what I'm seeing.
Right.
That's a good way to tap into their, you know, essentially their experience, that otherwise
right.
you wouldn't know.
Yeah. Well, my guys will, they might get tired of hearing it, but they'll know what I'm thinking, because I like to talk about what I'm thinking, because I think it's because, A, you know, that information, though their scope is a slightly less, their angle that they're looking at, taking in, is a little bit smaller than mine, which is a little bit smaller than the chief's, right?
Sure, right. Exactly.
What they're seeing, but they need to size that building up. They need to kind of see, like, okay, you know, I know these buildings. I know where the stairs are here. I know where, or this is a little different. This one's going to require something different. And so we do that, you know, I mean, every time we're out on the street, we're looking at buildings and I'm telling them what I'm seeing, or I'm getting to the point where I'm asking them what they're seeing, you know?
That's fantastic. That's the conversation that needs to be going on in the cab of the truck, instead of just, you know, four guys looking at a cell phone all day, looking at TikTok videos. I'm not saying it all has to be that all day, but you know, and me and my partner, we constantly talk about, you know, things that look weird to us, you know, and we'll even stop the truck on some occasions to be like, let's check what is that? Why is that like that? Let's find out more information. And then, you know, basically on every, you know, EMS run or whatever, my eye is always to the building, just to kind of pull something away
right.
from that environment that I can. So that, and I think that's just a great way to, like I said, again, get familiar with their environment. So,
yeah. So just again, it's not a building construction is not a separate class. Mm-hmm. It is part of what we do. It's where we operate. Right.
Right.
And it's not a trivia contest. You know, those things are important to know.
Sure.
Because, again, I want to minimize, just like you practice your stretch or you're still, or any of the things you can do to eliminate, you know, the fire and you know, the things that come with that present enough variables, right? We want to minimize the self-imposed variables that we don't have, whether it's, getting down or masking up, you know, really quickly or whatever, all those little things that we can, you know, get buttoned up. We want to, right.
Sure.
So we're not throwing additional variables at it. We don't need them, you know,
right.
I'm
yeah,
sure
yeah,
that,
yeah, yeah. You want to front,
you know, load. LeBron James doesn't go out with his shoes untied and or forget to tape his wrist or whatever, you know, that sort of thing.
Sure. Yeah. Like, you know, like I was saying, you want to front load as much information to put the odds in your favor as you can, because, you know, that's something that a lot of outsiders don't realize is we're going into the situation with so much unknowns that any other industry that operates like us in emergency response mode, whether it's the Coast Guard, the military, the SWAT, you know, like whatever that is, they have a good amount of intel that, you know, and that we just don't have. But like you said, but we can get around that by front loading the information as much as possible and
sure.
ruling out the variables as much as possible, which and a lot of times the conditions aren't the problem, right? We show up with all the solutions to smoke and fire and trap people. We have all that on the truck, but what we don't have is a tool to fix a broke building, right? The environment is really the big hazard for us. So yeah, all the things you're hitting on are just really chipping away at that risk and hazard that makes our environment safer for us to, you know, operate more optimally.
So kind of talking about front loading the information, when you're doing a size up, where do you specifically start and what are some things that you're looking for?
When I am doing a size up, I am looking for, I mean, the obvious stuff, what the smoke's doing, where it's coming from, you know, velocity, the whole, I mean, if anyone hasn't done any sort of reading smoke class. There's a lot of that. That's one that's pretty useful. The online stuff is pretty good. They do some pretty good. Phil Jost out of Seattle is doing that stuff now, and it just kind of gets your mind in that mindset. I think my sizing up has improved over the years because of going out and figuring out what's important, what's not important. But I think one of the things that's real important is to make sure that you're not seeing too much all at once, because it can get really overwhelming. Mm-hmm. Make sure you're seeing the building, make sure you're seeing the smoke, what it's doing. Get a good look at the building as much as you can, all sides. Obviously, if you can't get to the back, have somebody get to the back and get that information to you. I'll give an example of one we had. Sometimes there's little clues, and I don't know that there was a building we had companies I work with now, it's not assigned here yet, had a fire person's trapped in what appeared to be a two family that had been converted to a five family. And on the size of, see if you get around back, it was just much longer. It had a weird addition. It was brick. It was ordinary construction, probably been done years ago. But there was a small wooden board, little circle on the front doors. The only indicator, there was not five mailboxes. There was not, but there was five little doorbells between the two. Mm-hmm. And there was some miscommunication about, the woman said her son was in the front of the apartment, but that was the front of her apartment, which was in the rear. So, those are all like little things that you can try to pick up, small things that you can try to see. It's just, it's important not to get overwhelmed, I think, mm-hmm. don't try to see everything all at once. I think that's it. And try to see if you can see where smoke's pushing out of, is it, got to start, where is it, below you, above you, did it extend? So we have a lot of flat roofs. I don't know if most people deal with that, but if you're, if your fire is on the floor below the roof, do you have a pitched roof above it? Because that's the fire we're going to attack differently. If it's in the cockloft, we're just going to get it from underneath. But if it's in an attic space, so an awareness of the roof type. In fact, I'd like to see that, whether it's a pitched or flat roof, added to our size ups.
That does send a lot of benefits, downwind when that information is conveyed early on in a size up. Because it does kind of initiate some different movements by the companies that would be doing that, the top side work and stuff.
I came to that when I missed one. It was a building I should have. It was a building I'd been to before, and I just I was doing my 360. It was a fair bit of smoke coming out of it. It was a little close to the building, and although we don't call that in, mm-hmm. I thought it was important, and I missed that. It was a pitched roof, and it just, I think it delayed getting the second line to the half story above a little bit, and still a little more damage that perhaps had I
right. Yeah, and that's what people
added that to my size up.
So everything in St. Louis, most everything has a basement, and then once you throw a half story in there, two and a half story, that's four levels of building that you have to rule out for fire. And that's what people don't realize, is that some people might look at that as just a two-story, but really there's four levels there that you have firefighting to be done in some cases. That's where that half story can kind of, it creeps in and gets you sometimes like that.
So, Greg, since you're still kind of has a mix of the modern construction coming in, what's the biggest difference between sizing up a legacy building and a modern one? Or is there a difference,
I guess? But what we're seeing is some of these modern buildings, and they are, to me, I think one of the primary factors is because these are multifamilies for the most part. And I would say one of the bigger differences there is I think we've seen once if those fires kind of escape the box, that you can have some catastrophic results. Seen that across the country. And so I think one of the things would be pretty early getting on the idea of whether you're going to evacuate a refuge in place in this thing. Mm-hmm. As far as you know, the single families and two families and that, I just think it's just an awareness of, you know, things might move a little faster in the are going to move a little faster in the lightweight construction buildings. Awareness of the floor, you know, the floor construction, things like that, that you just, you know, I don't think, well, what's that James Johnson says, what does he say? Facts, not fear, I think is his thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's, I can't remember, one of those guys. But anyway, just not to necessarily be afraid of those lightweight construction buildings, but just aware of how they're going to, you know, how much time you have in them, how they're going to burn. I will say this, the A shift had a fire in an apartment building, part of a large complex that, Chris, I don't know if you went to that one. It's on Edsel there, or actually it was on Clara, but Clara, Edsel, all the way up to Hamilton.
Yeah, no, I don't recall that.
There's apartment buildings out there that are newer, and we had a gas call on one going back to when I was 28, a natural gas leak, and we knew the building was filled with gas because the gas company was there, and they said that the meter had been just, you know, it had just been spinning, so they shut it off from the outside, but they had, so I said, well, what kind of readings do you have? He said, we have zero readings outside, absolutely nothing, but we knew it was filled with gas. Okay, so we still have to address it. It's filled with gas, right? Well, what does that tell us? It tells us how tight these buildings are. Sure. And that fire they had, this was just going back a couple weeks ago, actually had somebody trapped in there. And I don't know if he survived or not. They had nothing showing when they got there, you know. So some of these buildings, and it's not to say that an ordinary construction building can't be tightened up like that, but we see a lot more with modern buildings, you know, how tight they can be, so you might not see anything initially.
Sure. Oh, yeah, you're talking about the one recently with, I believe, the 13s were first in on that?
Yeah, the 13s, Page and Clara there.
Right.
Yeah,
that was, that's right, that was in some multifamily lighter weight stuff. There was minimal, that was a classic example of smoke is, you know, in some cases deadlier than, actually in most cases deadlier than fire. It was there's no fire showing, minimal amount of smoke, if any, in the front, plus it was at night, plus there is a tree, you know, there's obstruction visually in the front, and the most of the activity from the fire perspective was in the rear, which this was a row, so we actually my partner and I went through an apartment to get to the rear, and from there, you could kind of see there was something going on the top floor. But by that time, they had figured out that there was an active fire. And as far as the person was located on the top floor and brought down the stairs out the back. But yeah, that's a perfect example of, yeah, I mean, that was, you know, on scene, nothing showing, basically. And, you know, obviously, you know what that does to the response. You know, everyone kind of lets their guard down, and then all of a sudden it got real.
Right.
But,
and that actually, so one of our, so that's, that is, although that was the 13's first two, that's right next to us. And we, and you know, we'll be first in just probably 40% of the time over there.
Sure.
In those buildings. And recognizing the patterns of the first floor units are, there are one story, and then the second floor is two and three, you know, just kind of recognizing more patterns and how the buildings are laid out.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was a weird layout with the access to the, we didn't know how to get to the top floor because, and the fire wasn't found immediately either. It's not like the first in company found the fire right off the bat. It was, most of the assignment was there, or all of it was already there before the fire was actually located. They had some trouble finding the fire, because they just didn't, you know, it wasn't that obvious. You're right. And I guess that, I'm looking back, like, just thinking back now, the last two or three victims we've recovered at a fire have been kind of that situation to where it's been a lighter weight, multifamily, not a lot of fire, but a lot of smoke, and it wasn't so obvious where the fire was at. Maybe a lot of smoke coming from the eaves, so it was actually a little bit of kind of throws you off. You show up and you think, wow, this is in the attic, top floor, and maybe not the case. You know, maybe it was just a common stairwell or something, but that's just where all the smoke went. It was nowhere near the attic. The attic was completely clear, but it was just a large volume of smoke coming from maybe a second floor and going up into that space, which those spaces are wide open. Obviously, we know that the big, you know, the truss voids, and it's not a cock loft like that. It doesn't have, they don't have fire breaks. If they do, they're minimal in effectiveness. But yeah, looking back now, yeah, I guess that's probably this year alone, and I can recall at least three similar situation with victims lightweight like that, where it wasn't so easy to tell. And my personal experience with the lightweight stuff has been good. You know, the drywall holds the fire. When we do have a good amount of fire, whether it's one or two rooms, it stays in those one or two rooms. It doesn't go anywhere. And I think a lot of that goes to our response. We don't have long responses, right? We have a very high company saturation spread over 62 square miles. You know, so I think we get the best benefit out of the drywall and the newer construction than most places. But I don't know what your experience has been with the lighter weight stuff, but you know, I would say all of it has been good, surprisingly good with the fire stopping capability of the newer stuff. You know, it hasn't gotten through the drywall and up into the trusses. You know, we haven't burnt off the top of the building. You know, it's not gone when you get there. That just hasn't been the case. So
talking about buildings that kind of can throw you off if you don't, you know, get out and understand what they are, has a building ever caught you by surprise? Like you sized it up one way and it was actually something else. And, you know, in hindsight being what it is, was there something that you missed specifically that would have clued you into that?
I'm sure that's the case. But, you know, I did mention the one where I kind of missed that it was a pitched roof and there was a access to the, but it didn't really surprise me. It just kind of made me like want to kick myself for having missed it.
I guarantee you this is something that's that we go through a lot more than most cities, if not probably some the most is multiple fires in multiple locations, right? And that's the one thing that we see that most people don't see, and that definitely throws things off. Because how many times have we been, you know, fire in the basement? We mop that one up, it's out, and then all of a sudden, the third floor has heavy black smoke coming out of it. And that's not because that fire in the basement went up a pipe chase. That's because that fire in the top floor was never found or just became found. Two or three different fires in two or three different locations, right?
When talking about multiple fires in multiple locations, how does building construction play into that in your guys' tactics and kind of what you're looking for? Does that make a difference for what you guys do when you approach these fires?
Multiple fires within the building. As far as like multiple set fires, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, in the end, I guess I don't know that it really changes anything other than, you know, we have to look for whether it's, you know, I mean, we have to go in and extinguish the fire where, regardless of where it is or how it got there. And then it maybe speaks more to the overhaul process and us kind of addressing how the fire spread, where the fire could have gotten to. And that, I think, Chris had mentioned about how we'll go back to, and I can't remember if it was, earlier in the conversation or in your previous, podcast, but how we'll go back and fight fires in the same buildings over some same vacants over and over. In the same way, is that building still structurally sound enough for us to you know, get in there and more of an awareness of the condition of the building and how conditions can change and deteriorate. But the overhaul stuff, I think, is really important. And I think you actually reposted some of the stuff from, I think it was Captain Schreiber from Colorado Springs, I thought was a really fantastic video on overhaul, and that, though he was referring to balloon frame construction, a lot of that transfer is actually in the overhaul process. So, not sure if that's answering your question or not.
No, that helps. And yeah, that is a good video series for anybody listening to check out. He talks about like legacy overhaul, and like you said, specifically in balloon frame, I think he talks a little bit about half stories, but just kind of like where to look and start for that process. So if you're kind of looking for some training, it's a little bit older, but it is relevant info. So kind of moving on, we talk about patterns in buildings, and I try, as you're learning building construction, trying to identify patterns and helping you make identification quicker. What does that mean to you exactly? So when someone says, like, tell me about some patterns in buildings, what comes to mind for you?
Well, what comes to mind is really that you're trying to simplify what we're doing. Mm-hmm. If you don't recognize patterns, if you don't notice patterns, is again, it's speaking of the amount of variables that you can process and have thrown at you. And if so, you're trying to, you know, limit that as much as you can. So recognizing the patterns in the buildings or maybe a lack of patterns, for, you know, it's all information for us to use to minimize the amount of things that we have to overcome. So, you know, in this building, so we'll have some older buildings. We'll recognize, okay, this one is going to have a rear stairs, maybe a servant stairs or something like that. Much narrower. The front stairs are going to be wider. These buildings won't have that. These buildings have half stories. We talked about some apartment buildings that have a unit on the first floor and the second, third floor is a unit. So we're trying to recognize patterns. And again, it's all serving the purpose of, you know, minimizing the amount of time it's going to take us to get to water and the fire and get that fire taken care of.
Now, when you're looking at these patterns, is this something that you're seeing like externally on the buildings, or is this something that where you've been in these buildings consistently, you just know, or is it a little bit of both?
Yeah, well, it wasn't something I really thought about initially, and it's just over time kind of recognizing that I was recognizing something. Mm-hmm. And also kind of nerd about baseball stats and that advanced stats sort of thing and kind of synthesizing stuff. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if that applies to what we do. And in some way. So now as an officer and somebody with, you know, more than two decades in the fire service, basically what I'm trying to do is, and I'll tell the guys this, like I'm trying to change the learning curve much, you know, steepen it so that they're gaining that, you know, a couple decades worth of experience, at least as much as you can in a couple of years, you know, they're start looking for stuff, because you can have, you know, lots of time on, but that doesn't always, you know, if you're not doing any kind of reflecting on what your experiences are, you're not looking for patterns, if that isn't a part of how you operate, or if you're just not getting in the street and looking, going through buildings, looking at buildings, mm-hmm. those things don't just, you know, they don't just naturally happen without putting some effort into it. So for me, again, I think I just sort of recognized that I recognized patterns and then started to figure out how to make it a little more systematic, mm-hmm. although that is not my strong point. Organization is not my strong point. But as we go out, go through buildings, like talking to the guys to, you know, help them to see the patterns. Mm-hmm. So, and make it more purposeful than what it was for me.
Right. So kind of tying off of that, what is it that you do to engage members in learning about construction? I'm kind of assuming, you know, in most places that, you know, building construction is not the ideal topic to be talked about, right? The one rare exception, we talked to Brian Bastinelli the other day, and that's a huge part of their department. But, I mean, that's just kind of, their buildings are a little different, right? So it kind of has to be. But in most places, that's not the case. So what do you do with your crews to kind of engage them in that and get them a little bit more interested in learning?
Well, I mean, a couple things. It's trying to figure out what motivates people and understand the value and the importance of building construction, no different than fire behavior or any of those other things. It's all part of the whole. So, so there's that, like what motivates them, and here's why I think you should be motivated to do this. And hopefully you can find, whether it's, do you want, if you could stop time and your house was on fire and your family was in there, would you want you to be the one who, got to take care of that? Mm-hmm. And I would say probably most of us should honestly say no, because if I could probably find somebody who's better at this than me, but I'm trying to be that person, if that makes sense. Yeah. So that's just speaking of the motivation part of it. I want to be that person that I would send into my own home. But right now I can name a bunch of people who had sent in before me because I'm still striving to reach that level. But then specifically talking about building instruction, it's just, this is what we do and this is where we do it. So it can't do anything but help you in, search in fire extinguishment and anything else to know your playing field. And I can't remember if I mentioned earlier, but I started thinking about, when St. Louis, a Cardinal fan, I remember watching as they're warming up before a game or the team comes in from out of town, they'll have, we're doing fielding practice, they'll have balls hit off the wall to see how that ball comes into play off of the wall so that the outfielder knows how to play that ball, or they'll have interesting little corners at Fenway Park. How's that ball going to come off the Green Monsters, the left field wall? How's that ball going to play if you in basketball, they play in different arenas. You kind of have to adjust their shooting for the background, So they're trying to get as good at that environment as they can. What's different? We're trying to be as good as we can in the environment that we are in. So building instruction is essential to that.
No, absolutely. And I think that's a really good analogy for people to take too. So what kind of resources do you recommend for individuals wanting to study building construction, whether they're, brand new recruit, this is their first firehouse, or someone that's been in the business a while? What resources do you recommend?
Well, there's all the classics, the standard books, and I guess it's Glenn Corbett does the Brannigan construction book. I imagine you've probably heard of I think it's Francis Chang, the illustrated building construction book. That's pretty cool. I think that they're probably the ideal book is probably to be written. It would probably be combining some elements of those things. Mm-hmm. But James Johnson is great if you have an opportunity. Bud Henkel's online, he does some. I'd love to see it. I don't know if you've seen his stuff, but he actually frames out little models.
Those are pretty cool.
That's not accessible for everybody. Mm-hmm. I think the ideal book, the ideal class is to be, hasn't been created yet. But those are some of the resources that I use.
So if somebody wanted to reach out to you for more information on the stuff we discussed, or had any kind of questions about, St. Louis or anything like that, do you mind providing some kind of contact information, either social media or email or something?
Sure. On social media, on Twitter, I'm at Greg Redmond, STL, GREGREDMOND STL. And or you can email me redmond.greg@gmail.com.
Cool. Well, that's all I got, unless you have anything else you wanted to add, Greg.
No. I appreciate what you guys are doing. It's important stuff. Cool. I am up here in La Crosse, Wisconsin, on my way to vacation trip at Lake Superior and admiring the Main Street brick building construction they have here.
Cool. Yeah, it's really neat. The way you hit on stuff with patterns and you pick up on the nuances in the buildings, just, you know, that's what makes residential size up so unique opposed to just other occupancies, because the variables there and the variance there is infinite. You know, I can't just say, you know, an auto shop built in 1940, you can probably name off a couple of things with that without even seeing the building. But if I just say, you know, a type 3 residential two-story, you know, residential, that could be a million different things. So it's really good to.
Exactly. For sure.
It's
I think probably the type 1, type 2, that whole typing thing probably needs to go away.
And yeah.
We could probably do a better job of categorizing our buildings and describing them.
Sure. And like I said, that's, like you were hitting on with the patterns, and this is really where it comes from, the getting out in your neighborhoods and picking up on the tiny characteristics in the buildings. So instead of just whittling it down to one actual structure, you're talking about a general neighborhood characteristic. So that helps you a lot with you remembering different things and how the residential houses are set up and the layouts and the characteristics. And that's all part of residential layouts and looking for the patterns and stuff like that. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned something there that I try to teach, is that we want to try to remember as little as possible and know as much as possible.
Sure.
Because it's a lot harder to try to remember stuff at that moment, you know, when you're stressed out and all that. But if it's something you know, it's become part of your knowledge base. Mm-hmm. It's going to serve you a lot better than trying to remember something.
Good.
That's cool. I like that. Well, thanks again, Greg. We really appreciate your time. Hopefully you enjoy the rest of your class and your vacation. Have a safe trip.
All right. Thank you.
See you, Greg.
Yep. Take care.
Please be sure to check out Greg's post on social media. He is a great resource of information. Thanks again for listening. We hope this encourages you to take a deeper look at the buildings in your area. Have a great night.